I've just about had enough of you.
Affirmative, Day. I read you. I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Hello, and welcome to 50 Years of Shit Robots 100.
Yay! Really?
I'm so glad that it's this film.
Yeah, me
it's
too.
Reached 100.
Although I wouldn't have minded had it been a really shit robot. That might have been maybe more apt.
You're going to have to go back to them. You do realise that, don't you? You're going to be in withdrawals.
No. This is Matt and Stephen bringing you dispatches from the edge of robot films. Because it's episode 100, I thought I'd just like do a little review of some of the robots that we've liked. So the idea of the podcast is that we're going from 1927, which is when the film Metropolis was released, all the way to 1977, when the film Star Wars was released, because those films both have lovely robots. Maria in Metropolis, C-3PO in Star Wars. And we were just asking the question, were all the other robots in between those two films complete and utter shit? And the answer is no, they weren't. And we have given not shit status to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 robots.
Really?
In our series, yeah. How many of them can you remember?
Oh, okay, here we go. Tin Man.
Yeah, I've included Maria in that as well.
All right, Maria.
So, yeah. Maria, Tin Man, yeah.
Tin Man.
The tinsmith forgot to give me a heart.
Robbie.
Yeah.
I am at your disposal with 187 other languages along with their various dialects and sub-tongues.
Gort.
Yeah.
Gort. Latu. Barada. Nikto.
The humanoids.
Creation of the humanoids, yeah.
We did make you a bit thinner. You had a tendency to be plump.
Kenneth Williams from Barbarella.
Yeah. The robot. The AI Ken. From Ken. Barbarella, yeah.
Acceleration into temporal space continuum now beginning.
The Daleks, eventually.
Yeah, the Daleks, yeah, yeah.
The young one is approaching the forest. She will be there in a moment now.
Well, one is your absolute favourite, Robot John.
Oh, Robot John, yes.
Yeah. From the film, what film is that from?
Planet of Storms.
Yeah. Is it Amiga from First Spaceship on Venus?
Yes, Omega.
Omega, yeah.
As they pronounced it.
Omega, what's the weather report for the next 10 hours?
The barometer will rise by an anchor.
Well, that's fantastic.
And then we've got the 1964 Outer Limits robot, iRobot.
Ah, okay. Yeah, yeah. Adam Link.
Adam Link.
I read every book in Dr. Link's library. There was one volume on law.
And we've got the Avengers robots.
The Cybernauts.
Cybernauts. We're not shit.
My face of pleasure, then. I wish to express my pleasure to Mr. Guff.
And last but not least, the AI in Alphaville.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's not shit.
Sweet, yes, that's really could be DC's yo.
So it means that AI has a 100% record so far, because we've had Alphaville AI and Ken from a Barbarella.
Can we remember the real name of that robot?
but maybe that's something to do with the sort of the choices that the filmmakers can make about how to represent an AI. Because in both those, they do it really brilliantly, don't they?
Yeah. The voices are interesting because
yes.
Hal's this monotone, so still kind of peaceful voice. And and the one in Barbarella is slightly camp.
Kenneth Williams.
Kenneth Williams, slightly camp.
Yeah.
One in Alphaville sounds like it's somebody with throat cancer.
Well, it was done by somebody with throat cancer.
Exactly, with the microphone on the throat.
Yeah.
So we do have quite a nice list in our pantheon.
We do, don't we? So this is effectively our Hall of Fame that you came up with two episodes ago. So maybe what we should do is We should do deep dives on our Hall of Famers at some point.
Yeah.
Might be quite nice.
Elaborate.
Elaborate on them. So, happy 100th birthday, Stephen Murray.
How have we managed it?
I don't know. I don't remember. I don't know if I've already said this on the podcast, but when we were first chatting about the idea of doing a podcast together, you basically said, yeah, I think it'll be like 4 or 5 episodes long. We'll do 1927 to 1957 in episode one. And here we are, 100 episodes later, and we're only at 1968.
Oh, wow.
Which is very exciting. This is episode 7 of our odyssey into the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, looking at the AI HAL. And I don't know, it's hard, you know, you just said, will this be the last one? And I don't know. So hard to tell, isn't it?
Well, it is. At what point does a mini-series become a series?
Yeah, I know. And it did make me think that when we get to Star Wars, we'll probably be doing like about 3 series on that, won't we? 3 actual seasons on Star Wars.
God only knows. Because, I mean, Lucas tinkers. We'd have to deal with Lucas's tinkering.
We do. We absolutely do. Are at the moment in the film where you see the title card, which says Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite.
Yeah, leave everything at the door. Yeah. Just leave everything at the door now.
Yes.
Because the film up to now has been fairly comprehensible.
Yes.
But now, no, just no. Strip actually, naked,
yeah.
Take your brain out, and then move forward.
Move forward, yeah. So essentially, this is the back end of Dave Bowman's Strange Day.
I love the way you describe it as a strange day.
He's already gone through an AI trying to kill him, an AI that has killed all of his shipmates as well. And now it gets even stranger. So we have the title card, Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite, and then we hear Atmospheres by Ligeti.
Yes, Giorgio Ligeti.
Yeah, which is has accompanied us throughout this journey at various stages, usually when the monolith appears, which is sort of why it's here now, isn't it? Because we're about to see another monolith. Or is it the same monolith?
Well, somebody did actually ask me that on TikTok. Is the monolith that Moon, is it Moonwatcher?
Yes.
The Moonwatcher and his tribe touch. Yeah. Is that the same monolith that's on the moon?
And is it?
It's never explained. There's only 4 scenes in the film where the monolith appears. And are the aliens economic? I mean, do they want to save on their tech?
Recycle.
So I'm going with the fact that it is.
So the first monolith is sort of aliens giving hominids the next sort of evolutionary step, isn't it?
Yeah.
Giving them an evolutionary advantage over other hominids so that they kind of get the idea of weapons.
And I think this is significant to the next bit that we're going to look at in that the two tenets that bookend 2,000 years of our existences, which is Christianity at one end and Darwinism at the other, that's out the window because there is no God. Which is why probably he used also Spake Zarathustra, which was a nod to Nietzsche, who famously said, God is dead. Mm. And Darwinism, because, you know, evolution has been speeded up to some degree or created by aliens.
Yeah.
So that's gone.
Yeah. The second monolith, which is buried on the moon, gives us the knowledge that extraterrestrials exist. And we had to prove ourselves in order to get that knowledge by being able to leave planet Earth. And it also then, that monolith then kind of like sends a signal to Jupiter, which kind of gives us a pathway to the final monolith, doesn't it?
Yeah, which is floating in space.
Floating in space around Jupiter, which ends up, spoiler alert, being a gateway to like another dimension or another bit of the universe.
I think it has to be dimensional as well as spatial.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, love. I was saying to our Edna earlier, it's got to have a dimensional aspect to it.
I wish Coronation Street would actually dip into that kind of thing. I think it would be marvellous.
Ina Sharples was in here talking the other day about dimensional aspects.
Well, she's got a cat and she's called it Schrodinger. She can never find it.
Yeah. This is tangent alert. Tangent alert. There's a brilliant cut on YouTube of, so in when you watch Coronation Street, every time one of the characters says the word London, then the response is always the same, and the response by the other person they're talking to is always London, like that. So you've got this person has created a supercut of characters saying, "I'm off to London." London?
Completely non-relevant, but I'm in.
I'm on my way to London.
London? She's on her way to London. London!
Great. Okay, tangent over. So the first thing we see in this after the title card is Jupiter and moons.
Another syzygy.
This film was made before we had like super high def pictures of Jupiter.
We had none.
How realistic is this? Is this image of Jupiter?
It is actually fairly realistic to the kind of imagery that we would have gotten with our telescopes at the time. Ish. Okay. But we knew there were storms on there. We knew that it had this kind of gyrating bands of clouds. So again, Douglas Trumbull recreated it, and he created it in strips and put it all together and animated it, and it looks great.
Yeah, we see Jupiter and the moons, and then we see Discovery One in shot, sort of like not really moving. Then we see the monolith. We've got lots of shots of the monolith in sort of relative positions to Jupiter. And it looks massive.
Yeah, it looks huge.
So it looks like the biggest monolith we've seen so far.
Yeah.
But everything apart from the monolith is obviously like a rectangular shape. Everything else is very circular. So you've got like all of the moons and all of Jupiter. And then you've got a shot of the sort of bulbous Death Star bit of Discovery One. And then you've got a shot of the pod bay doors opening, and that's a circle. And then you've got the pod coming out of the ship, and that's a circle. So everything is very, very circular. I've no idea whether that is significant. But it did strike me. Everything is so circular apart from the monolith.
Yeah, it is. You're right. And I think that makes the monolith kind of really stand out in a very geometrical way. It kind of breaks it up.
Yeah. Just want to just give a shout out to probably old Trumbull for the way that when the pod opens, pod bay doors open and the pod exits and Dave's in the pod for the last time, the light that sort of spills out is just beautiful. It's so clever and so brilliantly done.
I think it's possibly the first film where they used lens flare as well. Which is an odd thing to use, because if people who are in the know that you only get lens flare when you're looking through a lens. Yeah. So
I have to say I hate lens flare on things, because it does exactly that for me. It takes me out of the story because it's like I'm aware suddenly of the camera.
The first Star Trek reboot recently.
It's just bloody J.J. Abrams just does
it's lens just flare lens all the time. Flare everywhere. I mean, sometimes the entire cast is obscured by a lens flare.
Yes. So then you've got Pod Leaves Discovery One. So Dave's on the pod. We've just found out in the previous section that he's heard the video from Floyd.
The 4-million-year-old black monolith has remained completely inert. Its origin and purpose, still a total mystery.
That is actually the last thing that's said in the entire film. Its origins and purpose are still a total mystery. Yeah. Last words.
Mystery.
Then we carry on.
Yeah. I love the fact that the last word is mystery. I think that's brilliant. Then we've got shots of more sort of syllogies of planets and the monolith. And then we see the pod coming towards us. And then we get this this absolutely so beautiful, which is, again, it's the moons and it's Jupiter and it's the monolith. And then the camera pans up to a star field. And then the sort of light show begins.
From a point, and I love that, just from a single point.
So good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And now we're seeing things from the point of view of Dave, I suppose, aren't we? We're either seeing things from his point of view or we're seeing him looking at things. I think that this Stargate sequence, there's a few different bits to it, but there's this light sequence. Do you want to explain how they do the light show?
The slit scan.
Slit scan.
So if you...
Strap in, people.
If you're in the know, back in the past, if you were going to take a photograph of a lot of people, you would use a camera that would have a slit in it and the slit would move across. And the film at the back was static. The film would move across and it would create a huge panorama.
Okay.
And the stupid little kids like me would be at one end and then it would run round to the other end and I would be in the photograph twice.
Yes.
So if you can imagine, we've all probably done this by accident by leaving a shutter open a little bit too long and a car has gone past and you see a stream of light coming out of the car.
Yeah.
Now, if you had a neon light, a long neon light, and you moved that, instead of getting a point of light, you'd get a plane of light.
Yeah, okay. Okay. The sort of length of the light.
Yes, the length of the light. And because you've left the shutter open and you move the light across, it would create a flat plane of light.
Uh-huh.
Now, the way that Douglas Trumbull created this, that he was using a technique that had been used by John Whitney, who developed this to create title sequences for Hitchcock's films like Vertigo. Trumbull developed this technique by having a black sheet, completely black. The room has to be completely black, and there's a black plane in front, and there's a slit in it down the middle. And instead of the slit moving, the artwork moves behind the slit.
Okay.
So the camera is right in front of the slit on a dolly, on a track, and it moves very slowly towards the slit. And the artwork moves behind the slit slowly in one direction.
Okay.
And so each frame, though, takes about 4 to 5 minutes to create.
Okay.
That's one frame.
What is it, 20, 25 a second or 24 a second?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
So then all of that has to be done again for the right-hand side. Because if you see with the Stargate, you've got two sides coming from a point.
Okay.
And then other sequences were done by using a spherical slit. And so you get those twisty-turny
kind of.
So it's an incredibly long process. And it's incredibly clever, I think. The other sequences were created because film is made up of three different colours.
Mm.
If you change the order of the colours or if you omit one of the colours, you get that very weird kind of strange. The landscape shots were done like that.
Done like that. So you get sort of yellow landscapes with green skies or red skies.
And they did that with Bowman's Eye as well.
That's right. Very famous, where his eye blinks and it's different colours when it blinks.
Yeah, one of the most difficult things to do is the diamond shaped objects that fly through the sky, but they've also got animation on the side of them.
Yeah.
Each plane of that was done individually and then reconstructed.
There's another sort of effect as well, which is it's almost like galaxies being created and.
Oh yeah.
And
do you know how we did that?
Only because I've been researching it, so yes, I do. But it's just ink on oil, isn't it?
Ink on various different things
that
apparently were sitting around long enough that they ended up smelling really bad. But I've done this with my students as well.
Oh, cool.
But what we used is a very similar technique to Steven Spielberg that he uses for his skies. But it's exactly the same as you dropping various different types of ink into water tanks. You change the viscosity of the liquid in the tank as well, you get different effects. Also, if you drop ink on top of water, it will stay fairly solid. But then if you put a tiny drop of detergent on it, it explodes.
Okay. So,
and that's what they were doing, and they were recording it at high speed and then slowing it down.
Brilliant.
He was doing that himself. Kubrick was doing that himself. That was another one of his hands-on.
Love it. Absolutely love it. As a little sidebar to that then, quite a while ago we were talking about the fact that Stanley Kubrick has only ever won one Oscar, which seemed like a bit of a shame. And he won it for special effects for this film. And as we've chatted about quite a lot, there was a team of people who worked on the special effects on this, led by Trumbull?
Yeah.
Yeah. So led by Douglas Trumbull. But apparently the Oscars at the time, you were only allowed to name three people for an award. And because there were four people who worked on the special effects, Stanley Kubrick thought, well, I'll just stick my name down for it. And when he won it, he then kept it for himself.
Did. And Douglas Trumbull was peeved right to the very end. I watched an interview with him and he was very annoyed.
Very peeved.
Yeah, very, very peeved. Very
but
peeved.
It seems sort of ironic that the only Oscar that Stanley Kubrick won wasn't really his to win. One other sidebar. So this is like a tangent on a tangent. But it's a Douglas Trumbull tangent, which I thought was lovely. And I just wanted to get it in. So as we're talking about him, I just want to mention it now. Do you know where Douglas Trumbull is now?
He's dead.
He is dead. But
his ashes.
His last year, his ashes went up on a spaceship called the Celestis Enterprise flight. And there've been a few of these flights. I think the first one might have had Roddenberry's ashes on.
Yes. Yeah.
But this one, the Enterprise flight, contained portions of the remains. Oh, that doesn't sound very romantic, does it?
No, it does not.
Of Nichelle Nicholas from Star Trek, who played Uhuru. Actually, the Roddenberrys were on this flight as well. It went up last year. And both Margiel Barrett Roddenberry and Jean Roddenberry, as well as visual effects artist Douglas Trumbull, amongst others.
I wonder if they wanted that.
I don't know. It does seem, I mean, for Trumbull, I thought that was really lovely when I found out about that. I thought that was really sort of like a really fitting sort of, you know.
Do you? I don't. I think for the others I do, but not for Trumbull.
Why not? He, I mean, created Jupiter.
He did, but that was his. He was a very kind of jobby.
Job.
He was very jobby, and his greatest achievement was to create all the effects, camera effects, and lenses for rides like Back to the Future
in amusement parks.
Yes, he kind of pioneered those. He wanted to be remembered more for that kind of thing and for his innovation in cinematography.
Right.
Literally, I think he was just doing his job when he was working on 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Well, I suppose it's only a portion of his ashes.
It's maybe Jupiter there's
also,
a bit.
Yeah, there's also bits of his ashes on roller coaster rides.
And I have been reminded by another one of our listeners, Theo Matthew. He said Trumbull was asked to work on Star Wars, but had other commitments.
Rides. He was just doing
rides.
Yeah,
he was doing rides.
So once we've got through the Stargate, once Dave has got through the Stargate, we return to something like normality through his eye blinks, don't we? Which are different colours. And then finally they sort of return to sort of normal colour. And that's the sort of end of the journey through the Stargate. So we get his blinking eye. Then we get a view from the pod of like a French hotel bedroom or a French bedroom. And as you say, so my understanding is that this, almost at the point of filming, that it still wasn't worked out what this bit of the film would look like.
No.
until one of his technicians said, "I think we can do a French bedroom, okay?" and Kubrick sort of said, "Yeah, actually, that sort of fits in with what we want."
Yeah, it was kind of his family was staying at the Dorchester, and yeah, he took some photographs in there, and he kind of based the room on that kind of thing. And also, there's a connection to the paintings, and the style is from the Enlightenment.
Okay, so we see the view from the pod of the bedroom, then we see Dave's face shaking in the pod, and then we see the pod inside the room. So we've been enjoying atmospheres throughout this Stargate, and then suddenly the music stops and we have this sort of like kind of strange muffled sounds. And then the whole sequence basically is like Dave's face inside the pod, Dave's POV inside the pod, looking at Dave in full spacesuit who's outside the pod. Then you get close-up of Dave's head inside the helmet, but Dave now has wrinkles and grey hairs.
He's old.
He's aging. Then Dave walks through the bedroom, Dave in spacesuit in bathroom, looks in the mirror. Spacesuit Dave sees older Dave eating in another room. Old Dave gets up from the table and walks towards where spacesuit Dave was looking at him, but there's no one there. Old Dave sits and resumes eating. Old Dave accidentally breaks glass. Old Dave sees dying Dave in bed. Dying Dave looks up to where old Dave was and sees a monolith. Dying Dave replaced by baby in a ball. Title music, Moon, Earth, Space Baby, end.
Done and dusted. See you later. Bye.
Blue Danube over credits. So, yeah, so if we go back a bit to this strange muffled noises, because this whole sequence, I suppose one of the extraordinary aspects of this film, and maybe one of its enduring qualities, a legacy maybe, might be how much time people have spent trying to work out what this end sequence is all about.
Yeah, many, many different interpretations.
Yes.
My interpretation many, many years ago, even before the internet, was that the aliens had created this room as a holding pen for him, as something kind of familiar for him, but they're multidimensional, and because they've brought him in, he is multidimensional, which is why time is squeezed. I think what we've got to understand is in between he interrupts himself as well, which is a very multidimensional thing, because you can exist on various different planes and different dimensions. So for me, and the muffled sounds are most definitely the aliens, I think.
Yeah.
Now, you've got to understand, they began to run out of money for this film, and there was a whole kind of tranche of people that were coming up with ideas for the aliens, which were really interesting ideas. And Trumbull himself was asked to try to create a light, using all of his different techniques to try and create a being of energy, which Kubrick really liked the idea of. And I think very wisely, it was all kind of ditched.
Yeah, I think Kubrick's wife was involved in creating some alien concepts.
Yeah.
Then there was talk of a massive creature to take Dave by the hand.
Insectoid.
And then that Dan Richter, who was the actor who played Moon Watcher, that he was covered in tiny dots.
They punched them out with a little hole puncher, and then they covered the background in dots.
I know, that looks really amazing.
Yeah, and they lit it in a certain way that you couldn't really see anything until he moved, and then all of a sudden all the dot disruption created a strange creature.
Yeah, so Kubrick commissioned hundreds of alien concept artworks, and as you say, decided in the end to not go with any. I've just got a little quote from him. This is from a 1968 interview with Playboy magazine. And he said, you're free to speculate as you wish about the philosophical and allegorical meaning of the film. And such speculation is one indication that it has succeeded in gripping the audience at a deep level. But I don't want to spell out a verbal roadmap for 2001 that every viewer will feel obligated to pursue or else fear he's missed the point.
Well, that's handy, since they were running out of money and they had to come up with something.
Yeah. Apparently Clark, shortly after the film's release, said, "If anyone understands it on first viewing, we failed in our intention."
That's quite interesting, because that's what people say about quantum mechanics. Anybody who says they understand quantum mechanics doesn't understand quantum mechanics.
Yeah. I've heard interviews with Kubrick where he's basically said, look, the idea is that the aliens are sort of like examining humans, looking at humans in the way that it's like a zoo. And like we examine animals or look at animals in a zoo, which, as you say, is why they wanted to create an environment that is a bit like one that Dave will recognize, but also slightly not, in the way that zoos kind of try and recreate animal habitats, but obviously
considering they've been around for at least 4 million years that we know of, they could have got that right.
I've read as well some ideas that they took memories from Dave in order to create this room. There's some shots that haven't made it into the final film that were shot. One of them was where there's a phone directory, where the phone directory is completely blank,
and a telephone
that where the handset is glued to stuck to the top. And also there was a Gideon's Bible in there as well, but again it was completely blank. Which I suppose the idea that one might have seen phone directories or a Bible in a hotel room, but you know you couldn't recreate it from memory because you would never have memorized all the phone numbers or all of.
Would
the
it have been
Bible.
A clumsy metaphor if the Bible was in the film and it was empty?
Maybe, yeah. So I think that I feel comfortable with the idea that the room is aliens examining humanity.
Yeah, like I do too.
It also, I don't know if you've ever read Slaughterhouse-5.
I know it. I know that somebody is in, and it's all his memories of the war, and he's in an alien environment.
He's abducted by aliens at one point, and they put him in a zoo, in a human zoo. Yeah. But also the other thing that reminds me of Slaughterhouse-5 is this idea of like this the time, like time has no meaning in this room really.
Well, time has no meaning for the aliens because you know they've already spanned 4 million years.
Yeah, the other thing about the book that really reminds me of 2001 is this sense of time. In the book, the aliens talk about the fact that time sort of has no meaning, that all moments exist at the same time. I think Slaughterhouse-5 is one of my favourite books anyway, and so it was lovely that there's that sort of connection between this film and that book. Do you want to add anything about the room?
It was very hot.
The room was hot because of the lamps that underlit the floor.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, the whole floor. I love the floor.
Beautiful. I think it's brilliant. And also it meant that he could shoot it in wides, really big wides, because there was no lighting from above.
Yeah, that's which I thought was incredible. Really cool. Do you think the floor was the inspiration for disco floors after this one?
I don't know.
I've just got Travolta in my head now.
Yeah. But again, it's so brilliant. This film... there's none of it. Like Barbarella is just captured in aspic in 1968 or 67 or whenever it was. This film, though, all of the choices that were made, whether by accident or design, mean this film just looks so crisp and fresh, even in, 50 years later.
Just about every science fiction film that's ever made or written is always about the time that it was written in. Mm. There's very few that transcend. 1984 does transcend, I think, and is very relevant now. But I think this film is still relevant. We're still talking about it. We're still pondering the end. We're still jaw-droppingly astonished at the effects. And I think it holds up.
Now, the baby. Now we come to the baby. Apparently it was inspired by some photographs, the baby.
That's Leonard, problematic.
Leonard Nielsen's photos from A Child Is Born in 1965, which were photographs of fetuses which had been either aborted or maybe women had miscarried or
they were dead but they were shown as if these were amazing photographs of life, and they were used as well in the anti-abortion campaign.
And the star child is, I mean, again, that feels like this is like very much open to interpretation, the star child, do you think?
Yeah, well, very much so. Yeah. I think it's every time we encounter the monolith, we have a leap in our advancement. And so finally, But does Bowman die, or is he transformed? He raises his hand like the creation of Adam. Is he transformed into a higher being? Is he transformed into the next level of human advancement?
So Kubrick said of the star child, the star baby, said this is from a conversation during a telephone conversation with Arthur C. Clarke. And Arthur C. Clarke was sort of talking about his ideas for the ending. And apparently one idea clicked, which was Bowman will regress to infancy and will seem in the end as a baby in orbit. I've also seen Kubrick say that the film has a sort of like, it shows stages of evolution. You've got hominids to man to angel. Sort of
angel.
Invoking that sort of religious metaphor. But on that very subject of religious interpretations, here is what Kubrick said about it. This is again from the interview in Playboy. He was asked if 2001 was a religious film. And he said, I will say that the God concept is at the heart of 2001, but not any traditional anthropomorphic image of God. I don't believe in any of Earth's monotheistic religions, but I do believe that one can construct an intriguing scientific definition of God once you accept the fact that there are approximately 100 billion stars in our galaxy alone, that each star is a life-giving sun, and there are approximately 100 billion galaxies in just the visible universe. Given a planet in a stable orbit, not too hot, not too cold, and given a few billion years of chance chemical reactions created by the interaction of the sun's energy on the planet's chemicals, it's fairly certain that life in one form or another will eventually emerge. It's reasonable to assume that there must be, in fact, countless billions of such planets where biological life has arisen, and the odds of some proportion of such life developing intelligence are high. So I suppose it's talking about maybe the aliens are sort of in that sort of Clarkian way of anything that is advanced enough seems like magic. Maybe anything that's advanced enough seems like God.
Yeah, like we are to ants.
Yes, exactly. Or our dogs.
Oh.
Sort of feel like that's the sort of relationship, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Dave, through the Stargate, to me, is essentially a dog with its head out a window with its tongue out.
Oh, wow. Fabulous. And they live about as long as Bowman lived, didn't he, in his compound?
Yeah, exactly. One other thing I think is really interesting about this, about the ending, is that at the same time the film was going on and Kubrick was making the film, Arthur was writing the novel.
Yeah. And so in tandem.
In tandem, that's right. And so the ending has a slightly more defined quality to it in the novel than it does in the film. So it says, Clarke's novel explicitly identifies the monolith as a tool created by extraterrestrials that have been through many stages of evolution. The book explains the monolith much more specifically than the film, as a device capable of inducing a higher level of consciousness by directly interacting with the brain of pre-humans approaching it. The second as an alarm signal designed to alert its creators that humanity has reached a sufficient technological level for space travel. And the third as a gateway or portal to allow travel to other parts of the galaxy. It depicts Bowman traveling through some kind of interstellar switching station, which the book refers to as Grand Central, in which travelers go into a central hub and then are routed to their individual destinations. The book also depicts a crucial utterance by Bowman when he enters the portal via the monolith. His last statement is,
"Oh my God, it's full of stars.
This statement is not shown in the movie, but becomes crucial in the 1984 sequel, 2010, the year we make contact, which is based on the novel 2010 Odyssey 2. The book reveals that these aliens travel the cosmos, assisting lesser species to take evolutionary steps. Bowman explores the hotel room methodically and deduces that it is a kind of zoo created by aliens, fabricated from information derived from television transmissions from Earth intercepted by the TMA-1 monolith, in which he is being studied by the invisible alien entities." In the book as well, when the space baby returns to Earth, it blows up all of the bombs around
nuclear
the
weapons,
Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, or not, in the film, when the baby returns, there are no such bombs around the Earth. So maybe it has already done it.
And he's contemplating his next step as the Übermensch. It's funny because this also goes back to Nietzsche, who Kubrick was obsessed with, the creator of the Superman, the Übermensch. And of course, Bowman has achieved that, but he's a child.
Right, okay.
Also, when I was watching Denis Villeneuve's Arrival, I couldn't help but see the creatures that we were trying to make contact with in that film. They did it on a giant screen, so it was kind of like a metaphor for film itself. They even gave the two creatures that they were communicating with, they gave them the names of Abbott and Costello, which are movie entities, comedians that were in films. You could sort of think that when the film opens, you're just watching a big black blank screen, which could be the monolith, really, couldn't
that's
it?
That's true. You mean right at the beginning of the film?
Yeah, right at the very beginning. And then the monolith could represent the cinema screen.
Yeah. The screen is a gateway to other worlds, isn't it?
It is completely a gateway to another world. Yes. Many, many other worlds. And as dazzled as humanity for over 100 years.
Yeah.
God.
Well, I think that is a reasonable place to stop this episode.
Oh, wow.
Unless you have anything more to add about the ending or...
No.
Actually, I'll tell you what, while we've just talked about the novel, the Arthur C. Clarke novel, I do have one amazing story to end with. You might already know this with that big old brain of yours. So we've just said that while Kubrick was making the movie, Arthur C. Clarke was visiting the set, also chatting to Stanley via telegram or by phone or whatever about various aspects of it. But Arthur C. Clarke was slightly frustrated because he was writing the novelization, but Kubrick wouldn't let him release it until the film was out. I think he was worried that it would sort of steal the film's thunder a bit. And it put Arthur C. Clarke in a very delicate position for quite a specific and weird reason. So this is from the book Space Odyssey. Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke and the Making of a Masterpiece by Michael Benson. Again, I can't recommend this highly enough if you're into this sort of thing. There's this amazing story then, which is in 1966, the book says, Clarke returned to Ceylon, where he immediately found himself in a ludicrous position.
Despite, there's a joke there somewhere.
Despite having put more than 5,000 miles between himself and the daily struggle to shoot 2001, he discovered an all-new high-stakes set of film production issues confronting him. And the reason was that he had poured a significant amount of money into his partner, Mike Wilson's Sri Lankan James Bond parody, which was called Jamis Bandhu.
Wow.
It says Wilson, who had been behaving increasingly erratically, had devoted only fitful attention to the project. After shooting just over half the film, he simply dropped everything and left the country bound for England. Forced to protect his investment, which would soon rival the total sum he'd made from his involvement in 2001 thus far, Clarke had no recourse but to assume the role of film producer. If he could get the remaining scene shot, with luck, he might recoup at least some of his outlay from ticket sales. So while all of this while all of 2001 is going on, Arthur C. Clarke is embroiled in having to produce a James Bond parody. I thought it was brilliant.
A Sri Lankan James Bond parody,
which is I thought was superb.
Jamis Bandhu, I like it.
Yeah. Actually, I'm just going to see whether it ever got made. So this is from a website called Book Forum. It says, Kubrick's approach put Clarke in a tough spot. He wouldn't be paid until the film and the novel appeared, and he had his own set of out-of-control expenses. Back in Ceylon, Clarke was producing a film himself, a low-budget version of a James Bond movie. The film director, Mike Wilson, was also Clark's lover. As Benson put it, Clark had one foot planted in an escapist derivative third world popcorn feature and the other in the most sophisticated evocation of human origin and destiny Hollywood had ever attempted, with the latter funding the former. Kubrick loaned him money to keep going as Clark sent him script revisions for 2001. The Clark-produced Jamis Bandhu movie emerged before 2001 under the title Sorunguth Soru. It came out in 1967.
Oh, it doesn't exist.
There are only two references on the whole of the internet to this thing. It hasn't got any user reviews. There's no... Oh, hang on. Is there a synopsis? There's no synopsis. There's some cast and crew for it. But that is it. So it did come out, which was nice.
I think it is a wise thing for Kubrick to prevent the book from being published before the film.
I agree.
Totally. And I think Clark must realise that because it's so enigmatic, people would just buy the book to find out what the hell was going on.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. I completely agree. There we go. Let's put a pin in this episode. We still have more to discuss. We've got to the end of the film, at least.
I think the point is, it's therapy for you to let go.
I don't want to let go. And in the next episode, we'll talk about the reception for the film, which in many ways is almost as interesting as the film itself. And also, we shall be rating the robot. What will Hal be? Is he a shit robot? Find out in the next thrilling installment. 50
of the
of shit
not mini mini series.
So go and have a lie down, gird your loins for the next installment, and we will see you next time. Goodbye.
Its origin and purpose still a total mystery.